that all of our relationships and everything we do ultimately needs to be a response to that. So that's what kind of sits behind this. Discernment is not really a system. It's a process. It's a way of kind of trying to measure the movement of the spirits within myself. We do discernment every single day. We make decisions every day as we move through the day, whether we're going to respond to others with kindness and compassion or whether we're going to respond to them in ways that are not bad. Discernment involves our large decisions and our little decisions. We may not recognize any sort of process of discernment. Some decisions come to us very easily and quickly, and we just do. But St. Ignatius, who I'm going to spend the bulk of my time talking about, was less about a process of discernment and more about trying to form people into being good discerners. He came up with a series of rules and reflections that were there really to just help the average person become more in tune with what the Spirit was calling them to in their day-to-day lives. St. Ignatius of Loyola, of course, is the founder of the Jesuits. He was a soldier and was very wrapped up in kind of the idea of chivalry and the idea of bravery in his time. And as a young man, he had dreams of being this heroic kind of figure and cutting a big swath in the courts and amongst the ladies in his imagination. And his life was kind of spent in that until in the middle of a siege, he got hit with a cannonball and knocked him down for a long, long time. And as he was recuperating in his manor home in his hometown, he asked for books about chivalry and romance. And there were only two books in the whole house. They had to do with neither of those things. One of them was a book on the lives of the saints, and one of them was a book on the life of Christ. And St. Ignatius entered into this process in which he started reading those because he had nothing else to do, but found a great deal of inspiration, particularly in the lives of the saints. And those calls to kind of a life of heroism started to find themselves redirected toward sanctity and serving the church. And he noticed that he still had daydreams about being this really heroic military figure and one that in the view of the world would be powerful and noble. But he also found himself having these thoughts about his future as one who was trying to serve Christ. And the beginning of his ideas regarding discernment was the realization that when he would think about those two things, while in the moment both of them were exciting, when he thought about being a leader of military work and doing that sort of thing, after that sense of excitement faded away, he felt dissipated. But when he thought about doing God's will and reflecting on that, even when his revelry ended, he felt at peace. And he came to the realization there must be something to that in discerning what it is that God's calling me to. That those movements in my heart are saying something to me about where I'm supposed to go. And that was kind of the beginning of that. And he looks at it in two ways. The first is what he calls the discernment of spirits. And what he means by that is the discernment of all the voices that surround me or in my head, and trying to discern whether they are the spirit of truth and of goodness, or if they are the spirit of deceit or the evil one. And before we get too clear that that's like God or the devil, that's not quite what he means. When he speaks of the spirit of truth, he's speaking about all those voices in our life that are good and that call us to something outside of ourselves, to a certain sense of goodness. And when he speaks of the spirit of deceit or evil, he's really speaking of something, all the negative voices. It may be the evil one, but it also may be myself in the ways that I speak voices of despair and discouragement, or it may be the culture. And we can certainly say all that is rooted in something that is not of God. He divided that into the idea of consolations and desolations. And that the discernment of spirits is ultimately trying to determine, am I under the influence of the spirit of truth and encounter consolation? Or am I under the influence of the spirit of deceit and feel desolation in my life? And I'll get into that in a minute. It's a development of a skill. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, and the sheep will hear my voice and they'll recognize it, and they will follow me. They won't follow a deceiver because they don't know his voice, but they know my voice, and they will follow me. And so discernment in many ways is kind of entering into developing a skill that helps us to recognize the voice of the shepherd in our life. In any decision in life, there are a variety of voices that fill our heads and our hearts, right? I mean, our world is so full of voices and noise. And some of them are voices of condemnation. Some of them are voices of violence and anger. Some of them are voices of goodness and truth. Some of them we're not so sure what kind of voice they are. And the process of discernment is trying to name what those voices are and to determine what voice in my life, what voices in my life do I need to call. Discernment is about recognizing these voices and choosing to follow a particular voice. True and false spirits. The spirits either pull us toward the good, and therefore they pull us towards God, or they pull us away from the God coming from the devil. False spirit is an evil spirit of the enemy that's broader than simply the devil, but all those things, like I said, are psychological baggage, emotional weakness, anything else. But anything that creates a barrier or draws me away from the love that God has for me in Christ Jesus. The good spirit, the true spirit, is not only the Holy Spirit, but it's the good in the world. It's our happy life circumstance, like when we experience health. It's a life-altering experience of behaviors that are affirming. It's our psychological well-being, but it's something that pulls me towards God. And the principal way that Ignatius would see this is something that pulls me towards faith, hope, and charity. Spirit of good holds me distilled down to that more of the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. And the evil one is the one that pulls me away from that towards despair, towards hopelessness, towards faithlessness, towards apathy. Not really hate, but apathy, not caring, and not being passionate about anything. If I'm under the influence of the false spirit, I'm in a state of desolation. And if I'm under the influence of the true spirit, I'm in a state of consolation. Does that make sense? I know there's some preliminary stuff here I'm trying to work through, but that kind of makes sense there. There's two things that Ignatius is doing. One, he's trying to help us look within ourselves and discern what's going on inside. And it's by discerning what's going on inside that we then are able to discern how we're to proceed with decisions. So there's two levels of it there. So Ignatius begins with the idea of what's going on here, interiorly. And the only way he really has to do that is to talk about the characteristics of consolation and desolation. And in many ways, like everything, it's easier sometimes to talk about desolation and what it looks like than it is to talk about consolation. Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, right? And it consists of three parts, the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the one about heaven. And nobody reads the other ones. They only read the Inferno. Because nobody cares about anything, about what it, except what it's kind of look like. really, is the only one that anybody reads, it's oftentimes easy for us to see brokenness rather than good. But it's important for us to look at that. So what does desolation look like? What is the characteristics of desolation? Consolation and desolation, first of all, is more than just a feeling. It's not just about feeling good or bad. For instance, I can be in a place of consolation and feel grief over my past. That's called contrition. When I feel sorry for my sins, that's not a desolation. When I recognize my sin for what it is and I feel sorry for it, that's not desolation. It's a consolation. Why? Because it's helping me to grow towards Christ and helping me to grow towards what it is that He is inviting me into. And so it's not just do I feel good or feel bad. Because when we think about our sin, we don't particularly feel good. And so I can have grief on my past. Likewise, I can be in a place of desolation and feel pleasure from short-term fixations. Or subtle ones, right? So I mean, that's what drug abuse is about. Where we have a sense of high. Or a sense of filling ourselves, but in the end we're empty. It leaves us empty. There's a desolation behind it. We can fill our lives with many things. Possessions, money, or drugs, pornography. There's all sorts of stuff that we can fill our lives with. And yet none of that in the end makes us feel whole. We have that sense of pleasure. It comes in the moment, but it's temporary. And in the end we feel empty. And we feel broken. So what are the characteristics of desolation? An emptiness of faith, hope, and charity. A preoccupation with petty resentment, with worries, with superficial pleasures, with low-reaching goals. It's not necessarily about what I did, but what motivated or filled or resulted from these actions. Why did I do this? Is the action that I did, was it motivated by love? Or was it motivated by avoidance? And if it's motivated by avoidance and isolation, then that is a sign of desolation. Faith. Did my actions bring me to reflect a greater trust in God? Or do they rather lead me to isolation and to doubt? We all know those times in our lives, and we all need to be alone every now and then, right? But we know those times in our lives we behave in a way where we push away people that we actually need. That we know we need them. And then somehow we just isolate ourselves. And that is a sure sign of the experience of desolation, of being under that control. Hope. Does it lead me to optimism and confidence in what it is that I'm doing or where it is that God is calling me? Or are my experiences one that leads me to a place of despair or fear? Do I live out of fear? And do I live out of despair? That's the mark of desolation. Love. Is love something that leads me to a love? Is what I do lead me to a greater love of neighbor and of God? Or again, isolation, secrecy, avoidance, passivity, or aggressiveness towards other people? Anything that pulls me away from the theological virtues is something that pulls me away from the experience of consolation and leads me towards desolation. And so when I recognize that in my life, you know, I'm feeling this pull away from those things that I need in terms of faith, hope, and charity, then I know that on some level I'm experiencing a time of desolation in my life. Desolation is empty of the sense of God's presence. In prayer, this is often called dryness. Desolation in those times that we just don't feel God's presence with us. The word word desolation actually comes from desole, which means to be made alone. And that sense of loneliness, God feels distant from me. Those times that I really feel that, that sense of loss, of God not being there. Intellectually, we know that that's not true. Intellectually, by faith, we know that God is always near me. That he knows me more intimately than I know myself. That he knit me together in my mother's womb. The truth is God always is close. I may not feel it. I may not sense God's nearness. And that lack is desolation. A sense that God's not there. And so I can feel empty, abandoned. Ezekiel's dry bones statement. I looked out on the field and saw nothing but dry bones with no life in it. It's not unusual. God himself started, Jesus himself screaming from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Desolation is not only dryness, but an absence of hope and faith that it can change. And that's the difference. All of us have times of dryness in prayer. All of us have times we don't feel God's presence. Some of us experience that for a long period of time. The difference is between the great saints and the great mystics who cried out, if this is how you treat your friends, it's a wonder you don't have so many. It's no wonder you don't have so many. Saints have cried out that they never lost hope that God is close. I grew up in the, I was born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s, and Father Cary Landry published a bunch of children's songs on the album. It's called High God. Does anybody remember High God? The Indianapolis Museum of Art is on the cover. Mary Jane Kinghorn, the woman that sang with it, was wearing her leather boots and come up to her knees. It's awesome. It's great, very creative time. I grew up on that. I loved it. That's how Tom and I first connected, because he wrote a song called The Bright Giant Love All Song. We all knew what it was. But Cary Landry wrote a song called I Believe in the Sun. And it was based on an inscription that he found in a prison camp during World War II. And the inscription was simply, I believe in the sun even when isn't shining. I believe in love even when there's no one there. And I believe in God even when he is silent. Consolation is faith even when we don't feel the closeness of God. Desolation is a question of God's presence that could ever change. And that experience of desolation is one of the other things. A third thing is full of disquietude and agitation. For moving toward the good, then the evil spirit will come after us with feelings of uneasiness, unsettledness, and agitation, a lack of peace, anger, fear, laziness will seem to be larger than what it really is. We'll have this sense of disquiet. There's always an experience of agitation in our life, right? Always times of negative feelings, temptations, upsetting thoughts. What we need to be attentive to is how much these upset my peace of mind. So in the course of the day, all sorts of stuff happen to us, right? That are annoying, that can agitate us, that can get us. How much does that affect me deep into your book? Is really the bigger question. Am I able to kind of accept that and say, well, today wasn't a particularly good day? Or is that something that kind of cycles me into a deeper place of darkness and of uneasiness? If I set out to have no negative thoughts, feelings, etc., I'll fail. Right? So the point of this isn't that I have no negative feelings. Grief is a negative feeling. We encounter it, we experience that. But if I can't control how I respond, my attitudes, my hope, what do I feed? Which side do I feed? Maybe be the better way. If I can act negative thoughts in my mind, and I can choose to reinforce those thoughts, or I can choose a different path. I use the thing all the time that, you know, if I tell myself I'm tired all the time, I am going to be tired. No doubt about it. And I am tired sometimes. If I tell myself that I'm angry, hurt all the time, I will feel pretty much nothing but anger or hurt. If I allow myself to feed the destination in my heart, then I just move deeper and deeper and deeper into that. What do I feed? Perhaps one of the hardest things in desolation is boredom or apathy. And that's really kind of the biggest struggle in desolation. St. Ignatius spends a lot of time with apathy. He has a whole host of names for it: laziness, boredom, but ultimately it comes down to apathy. And he points out, as I said at the beginning, the opposite of love is not hate. Hate still implies relationship. Even if it's an ugly one, it still implies relationship. Apathy is nothing. Jesus got most angry when he was talking to the crowds and the Pharisees and the scribes and everybody else. He got most angry, not because they argued with him, but because they did nothing. God says to the prophet, "You are neither hot nor cold. You are tepid and lukewarm, and so I must spit you out." There's nothing the Lord can do with us when we just don't care. And we don't listen. And desolation is that sense of boredom. In all honesty, I find spiritually that I struggle the most at the two extremes. That when my life is in a normal rhythm and stuff like that, I'm generally, prayer's not so hard. I generally hump along okay. But when I got an enormous amount of time on my hands that I don't know what to do with, it's hard to pray. Anybody ever experienced that? It's like I got all day to just like lay around in my house, can't get myself dragged over to the chapel to spend a little bit of time in prayer, even though I got all day, got all the time in the world. Has any of you ever noticed, like, when I take my day off, I have to be disciplined about getting up and going out and doing something? Because if not, if I just kind of roll out of the bed to the couch and do that, by the end of that day, I feel horrible. I feel no better. I feel no rested. No rest. No rested. No more. And prayer's that way, too. When I am super stressed, when I have overloaded myself, when I got too much, that's a hard time for me to pray, but perhaps it's even harder when I got nothing. That experience of apathy and boredom, of really struggling to find the motivation, we all know what that is, struggling to find the motivation to do anything is an experience of desolation. But not being disciplined, like I said, spiritually or physically, getting yourself out of bed and going somewhere other than just the couch. The lack of desire to be in relationship with God, I don't feel like it. I just don't feel like it. It's not so much that I'm angry with God. I'm not really angry with God. It's not nothing to make me angry, but there, one can have the question, do you really want to be in relationship with God? But the answer may be not a whole lot right now. And that is kind of living under that experience and that spirit of desolation, of an apathy, of kind of not being present to that. The opposite of life is not death, just like the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of life is tepidness. It's boredom. It's indifference. Death is part of life. We're all going there. It's just part of it. Not living is being apathetic, tepid, bored, not moving. Another sign of desolation is fear and worry. The most persistent command of the gospel that Jesus makes, the very first words out of St. John Paul II's mouth when he was named Pope, was be not afraid. Be not afraid. It's the most consistent command that Jesus makes, that the angel makes. Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. Do not be afraid. Fear is crippling. Fear and worry, can govern us, can define our whole lives. I've said this before, I think I'm a man that definitely follows in the habits of my father when it comes to worry and fear. I go to sleep, I have no problem falling asleep, wake up in the middle of the night and start thinking. Dad did something that's crossword puzzles. Try and kind of set his mind and go back. But that sort of stuff can just start running in our heads, right? Control us. And can define us to the point where it becomes so big. And it's really not. It's just really not. Nor is there anything to really do about it. Ben, do not be afraid. Fear keeps us from rejoicing. It keeps us from discipleship. Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night. But he's fearful. Since he fears the Jews, which in the Gospel of John is a technical term for the leadership of the Sanhedrin. He's afraid, and he doesn't follow. He only comes to Jesus at night. Keeps the Pharisees from talking to him. Keeps the disciples from recognizing. Keeps the people from staying. Fear is a big motivator. Fear of loss, fear of pain. Probably the biggest one is the fear of being loved. Fear of being ourselves. Fear is allowing myself, think about this, fear is allowing myself, if consolation to some degree is living in the dream, in the hope of God, then fear is living in the nightmare of the evil one. Not my own truth, but what the evil one wants me to believe. Fear causes me to hoard. Think of how many people you know, or how many relationships in your life you know have been destroyed because somebody held on just a little too far. Instead of allowing a relationship with this freedom and they're loved, the person so feared losing the other person that they clung to them in a way that made the other person leave and walk away. The very thing that we need is the very thing that fear makes us act against. Our fear makes us act against the love and relationship we need. Fear makes us hoard things, makes us hoard pretty much everything, rather than to share them. When we're not fearful, we share. Right? When we're fearful, we grab our toy and run in our corner. You know, it's hard to believe, considering I stand up and do this stuff all the time, and every single day I stand up and preach, but when I was in seminary, I was scared to death to stand up in front of people. When I became a lector, the very first time I had to read in the chapel instead of the podium, and my knee was shaking so hard that the pant leg was going like that. When I got done preaching my first homily in my first homiletics class, the very first comment that was given to me from one of my classmates was, "Eric, don't be so afraid. Don't be so nervous," is what he said. Another classmate said that is entirely unhelpful. The first time I preached in my chapel as a deacon, I had three pages, and I was gripping this so I could not breathe. And somehow I was able to speak. You couldn't hear it in my voice. But there's a video of it because they taped everything. And I took the page. And it was literally like that. I mean, not trembling, but like violent. You could hear it through the whole chapel. You could hear it on the tape. I was so afraid of that. And yet, it was a fear that could keep me from doing what it was I thought it was called. So I was called to step into that. Not all fear is bad, you know. There are some things in life we should fear, but it's really irrational fear. It's the fear that takes over. I mean, I think part of what helped me get past the whole idea of speaking is I've gotten up in front of people enough and screwed up enough and didn't die. And at some point, you're like, I'm not going to die. And so you kind of step into that But it's the irrational fear that takes over. You know, you think of FDR as the only thing we have to fear is spirit itself, that's what he's talking about. Is that an irrational sort of experience of fear? God does sometimes call me to do things that are frightening. God did not promise you an easy life. Remember that God said to his disciples, anybody that gives up mothers and brothers and sisters and lands will receive many times over mothers and brothers and sisters and lands and persecutions. God will call us at times into difficult things. Fear is the desolation that says that I can't follow. The last thing that I think is probably one of the other most important things of desolation is desolation is a secret. And it's full of secrets. I've said this many times, but I had a professor and it sat very strong with me. And it's some of the problems we see right now that we're facing in our church. But he said, gentlemen, you are entitled to a private life, but not a secret life. The biggest sign that you're in trouble is when you decide to keep things secret from people that know you and are closest to you. And you come up with all sorts of things. Well, they won't understand. My situation's different. They're just going to overreact. I need to talk to him about this, but I just don't have time to do it right now, or he doesn't have time to do it right now. It's embarrassing. I have a friend who's a priest, and I never worry about it. Because no matter what he's thinking, sometimes you hear more than you want to hear. No matter what he's thinking, he tells you. He's, man, he's, and not just me, I mean, he's, there's a whole group of us, he just talks. There's nothing more dangerous in the experience of desolation, secrecy. It's the beginning. When you, if you're in your marriage, you start finding yourself hiding something, hiding a relationship. That's a big, big sign that says, wait a minute. There's a problem. We need to, desolation calls us to a place of secrecy. There's a false consolation that's really desolation, and that's when I think I'm doing something good, but the fact is I'm really doing it for the wrong reason. So I fast and I give other things for Lent, not out of love for God and trying to grow my relationship with Him, but to just prove how tough I am, or how good I am, or how I'm better than Joe over there, who doesn't fast quite as much as I do. Which is the problem of being counted in 1 Corinthians. That's what Paul is doing. Competition that exists in there. That's a false consolation. What are the characteristics of consolation? Well, it's really just the opposite of those experiences of desolation. Consolation brings us to faith, hope, and love. Negative experiences into positive options. False humility that is self-absorbed is not consolation. What it is a love, a faith, something that draws us towards the Lord. That experience of faith, hope, and charity is when I feel that welling up of a desire for the other, and not just me, and not just what it is and I think that I want. It's also about growing in the sense of closeness to God. I mean, consolation, I experience God's love for us in His presence. When creation leads me to a love of God, because it becomes an expression of God. I don't get wrapped up in the creature for itself, but I see creation as a means for understanding God and the Creator that's behind it. Awareness of God's providence. Consolation is peace and tranquility. Not a surface peace and a tranquility, but a deep sense of peace. not an absence of problems, but a peace in the midst of problems. You think of the song, How Can I Keep From Singing? No storm will break my inmost calm. That sense of that, a joy for a future good. You hear that in the accounts of the martyrs who are joyful in there at that last moment of the experience of death, even sarcastic. Flip me over, I'm done on this side. The sense of courage is supernatural, but it comes from a joy of knowing God's presence and His closeness and aware of that. A deep faith that no matter what I face and no matter how bad it gets, God will have His way. He will have His way. Consolation is a presence of holy desire, a desire to be like God. And again, just the opposite of secrets, consolation is a desire for transparency. What has been hidden in the darkness, you are to proclaim from the rooftops, to speak thoughts before they become actions. Think of how many thoughts we allow to dwell in our hearts and our minds that we wouldn't like anybody else to know about. And yet, if we cultivate those thoughts, they will manifest themselves in some way. My point is not really to say, what do we do? There are ways that Ignatius invites us to kind of deal with desolation in particular. How do we deal with that? We name it. We bring it out to the light. We avoid making changes in decisions. Discernment, one of the principal rules of discernment is don't make decisions when you're in desolation. And that is the great temptation, right? When life starts feeling like it's coming in on us, when we feel a sense of despair, when we feel fear, when we feel all those things, our greatest temptation is to run away from that. And St. Ignatius says, that is not the time to make decisions, because you are not in a healthy place to make those decisions. And so when we find ourselves in a place of desolation, St. Ignatius advises that that is the time when you sit still and you wait. And you wait until that desolation passes and the consolation of God comes across you. As I was doing some reading at one point, somebody said, you know, if you're riding on a camel across the desert and a sandstorm comes up, that is the time to jump off the camel, put your face to the ground and cover your head. That you stay still until the storm kind of passes. The other thing that is very important to that, and I'm going to move on to what we do in the face of desolation, but the biggest thing we do in the face of desolation is support from other people. We have a mentor in our life who can listen to us talk and say, and help us to see what's really going on in our hearts. That we have friends that we can be honest and transparent with. That we lean on the church, particularly the church's teaching, the lives of her saints, but most of all, the sacraments that are there. So with all that talk about discerning consolation and desolation, well, let me stop for a moment. Does any of that raise any questions for anybody? I'm glad I was so thorough. So then what does it mean when if we have this understanding of desolation in our heart and consolation, and part of our role is trying to determine where am I at in that? What am I feeling? Do I feel like a sense of consolation or do I feel a sense of desolation? If I'm discerning those spirits, then what does that mean for decision making in my life? Well, St. Ignatius would say that before we make any decisions at all, the first thing we have to do is kind of get rooted in fundamental questions. Who am I? What am I about? What am I called to? Instead of just jumping to the question itself, to step back and ask fundamentally kind of what's the place behind that decision. So if I'm dealing with a question of, well, do I take this job or not? This job opportunity that's in front of me. Well, before you just rush into that particular decision, to step back and say, well, what's important to me in life? What are the values that I have in my life that are on the table with this particular decision. There's a lot of stuff that don't necessarily involve just a job, right? What is this going to mean for my family? All those sorts of things. What's the value to me? And we need to understand that. As a Christian person, that means, first of all, what do you seek? Why are you here? What's really important to you? In my sacramental class for the sacrament of penance for reconciliation, at one point we had a long conversation about what do you do with somebody that walks in and tells you that they've done something, but they're not sorry and they're not going to change it. You know, contrition is, after all, something that is required for the sacrament. And so if I'm going to give absolution, I need to have some sense that there's a sense of contrition there. And the temptation, of course, to say, well, if you're not sorry, you're not going to change anything. There's nothing I can do. Have a good day. But the priest at that time, now Archabishop Kurt, really challenged us and said, you know, the question you need to ask, no matter what that person is saying in front of you, the question you need to ask is, why are they here? Why are they here? If it's true that he's not sorry and he doesn't have any intention to change things, why did he bother to walk his door? We have to begin with those deeper questions. Why are you here? What do you seek? The other thing that we need to kind of prepare ourselves to do is to cultivate a grateful heart. If we are bitter, if we are resentful, we're going to have a hard time making good decisions. The fact of the matter is God has given us everything. We are blessed people indeed, even in our suffering. God sent his only begotten Son. And so we're called to be grateful. And gratitude is not just a feeling. Gratitude is gratitude is something to cultivate. It's a discipline. Just as little kids, we had to learn how to say thank you. We need to remind ourselves we need to say thank you. I do think that as part of our prayer every single day, we need to take time to call to mind the ways that we have been blessed by God and to thank him every day. I say this in marriage homilies all the time, but Father Mark O'Keefe used to tell us, gentlemen, you need to thank God every day for the gift of your priesthood, even when you got to do it through gritted teeth. There does need to be a sense of gratitude in our hearts. When we lose that sense of gratitude, we just start thinking about ourselves. And let me tell you, folks, that is a lonely place. It's a lonely place. Gratitude is what opens us up to other things. So we have to cultivate gratitude. In Ignatian spirituality, that's through the example. Every single day, stopping and asking, where did I encounter God today? Where did he bless me? And to say thank you for that. And then also to say, well, where did I refuse to encounter God today? Where did I rebel? And to apologize for that. And to ask for forgiveness. For that twofold movement, gratitude and the gift that God gives me, as well as an experience of sorrow for my own sin. The ultimate outcome, I think, for like the sacrament of reconciliation, speaking of that, is gratitude, by the way. I mean, we walk in there with a bucket full of sins, right? And we're sitting there, not with our sin, not with what it is that we have done, but we're really sitting there with what it is that God does. With that. And our only response, when we really get that, our only response is gratefulness. Because we don't deserve it. It's a gift. Cultivating gratitude. One of the things that we have to keep behind us in all things is that everything that we do needs to be for the greater glory of God. That's the motto of the Jesuits, by the way. For the greater glory of God. We don't always think of it that way. But very early in my priesthood, dealing with some couples as they were preparing for marriage, one of the questions I asked is, what I asked them to pray on is, does this relationship lead you towards God? Or not? Because if you're a Christian person called to know, love, and serve God with everything that you have and all that you are, and And your decision to enter into this is something that should draw you into a deeper mystery of God's love, as an expression of God's love for God's glory. As a Christian people, that's part of our decision making. The last thing that St. Ignatius says that we have to do before we enter into that is cultivate what he calls indifference. We might call it renunciation. So when he says indifference, he doesn't mean that we don't have anything that we're passionate about. He basically is saying is that we are indifferent creatures in the face of the Creator. We don't allow things. We don't make God out of things. That God is God, and everything that we have in our world, we have to have a certain detachment from. Sometimes it's hard for us to feel that. So Ignatius says that there's a detachment of the heart, which is the natural detachment of I let go of this for the sake of God. And therefore, I choose not to control this for the sake of God. Sometimes we have a hard time doing that. So then he says we need to practice detachment of the will. He says, I don't feel like letting this go, but I'm going to try to decide to. We do that. Think about that. That's every creature. That includes our children, our spouses. We try to possess people that we love. We control them. If we're indifferent, as St. Ignatius would say, or we're detached, then we allow that person to be free. And therefore allow that person to be an object of love and not a possession. For Ignatius, the process of discernment ultimately begins with getting quiet and real quiet. And what he means by that is prayer. My brothers and sisters, prayer is a non-negotiable in the Christian life. I'll tell you, there's been a couple times that I've said that I've had people fight me pretty hard on that. But that is a hill I am not going to back off on. Prayer is a non-negotiable in the Christian life. That doesn't mean we all do it right or well. Any of us. But to somehow convince ourselves that it's unimportant is to give in to the voice of the evil one. Prayer is a non-negotiable. We must be quiet with God. We have to strive after that. If we want to be a people of discernment, to strive to see where God is and how it is that God is calling me, we must take time to recognize Him in prayer. It doesn't have to be long. We're not talking about heroic stretches of being down on your knees with your arms raised up to heaven for hours on end. It doesn't have to be long. It does have to be every day. There must be time every day set aside for quiet with God and to work at a discipline of that. And I think that's really, I think frankly that is a very practical thing. I've come to believe over time that prayer is something, the more concrete and structured it is, the better. If you're just like, well, I'm going to pray sometime today, you will not pray sometime today. If you say, I'm going to get up in the morning at this time, and the first thing I'm going to do is go down and I'm going to spend this much time in prayer, chances are you'll do that. And if you don't, you'll know immediately that you didn't do it, you'll feel guilty about it, and hopefully you'll go and do it later. I think it's concrete. I think if we have a concrete place, a concrete time, a concrete ritual through which we enter into that, that helps us even more. We stay present to that. I think if we have a mentor, I've had so many people, and I just myself have felt this way at times, and I just don't really know what I'm doing. Well, talk to somebody about it. Man, we've been praying as a Christian community for many, many years. There's some ideas that are out there that can help us. Mine has evolved. Right now, as a priest, my prayer primarily centers on my promise to pray the Liturgy of the Hours every day and the fact that I have to preach every single day. And so my prayers center around the readings of the day and center around the recitation of the Psalms.
and Liturgy of the Hours. And it follows a very, this is what I do. In the mornings, I walk in. Not every church you walk in with a cup of coffee. I have a chaplain house, so I do walk in, sit down, and I begin praying the Liturgy of the Hours. And allow that to be the means by which I enter into that. There's a private prayer for recitation of that which I pray in the invitatory. Come, let us sing to the Lord and rejoice in the God, the Rock who saves us. And then I sit with the readings of the day and I read over a few commentaries. And then I conclude with another set of Liturgy of the Hours because I'm going to pray the office of readings and morning prayer all at once because I won't separate those. And move on with my day, but it's a very structured, concrete thing. If I were to go in there in the morning and just sit down, within 30 seconds, I'd be like, I don't wear a watch, I'd be looking. And I just wouldn't be able to enter into that. I need something that pulls me to that. It reminds me when I just sit, pray, after pray, every single day. And I think it's good to have somebody to help you do that, because we all do that differently. Right? For some of us, certain styles of prayer help us, and for others, it just doesn't work. But we got to be committed to that. Don't give in to the idea, well, or don't give in to the idea that little things are wrong. I had a lot of great guys that taught me in seventh grade. Another one said, gentlemen, until you come to believe that prayer is the best possible use of your time, you will not find time for prayer. It's true. I struggle most in prayer when I decide that there are other things that are more important. Gather data. When you're getting ready to make a decision, make sure you know what you're talking about. Research. Explore your options. Consult. It used to drive me crazy as a vocation director. Guys would spend 3 years on my vocation website. And surfing all over the web, and then they walk into my office and say, I'm called to be a priest. I'm saying, hi, I'm Father Eric Johnson, vocation director. Nice to meet you. We can talk about that priesthood thing. We haven't had a conversation yet. It drove me nuts. You cannot discern without dialogue. You can't. Otherwise, it's just a fantasy in your head. For 6 months, I walked around Purdue University's campus wrestling with the same stupid question. And it wasn't until I finally talked to Paul Aitchen and my uncle and said, this is what's going on, and they asked the question, that I began to move and began to understand. Talk. Talk with a mentor. Mentors are a big deal. Find somebody you look up to and just say, pull them aside. Say, look, I just like somebody that I kind of trust that will listen to me a little bit when I need it. Pull them aside. Talk to friends. Have a conversation. I literally talked to nobody for the whole year. I got nowhere. By the time I talked to Paul, I was frustrated because I didn't get anywhere. And it was like the doors open. Learn about church's teaching. If I'm finding myself facing a moral dilemma and I don't really understand it, take the time to know. Learn. What does the church teach on this? What does the church teach with regards to contraception? What does the church teach with regards to anything that's out there? Be honest with myself. Am I a hasty decision maker? Do I jump to conclusions? Perhaps I need to slow down. Am I one of these guys that just can't make a decision? That I'm scared to death of closing a door? I am of the generation where people don't make commitments, by the way. Generation X, we have a problem with that. Am I that? Well, then maybe I need to give myself a deadline. Say, I will make a decision by this point. The next thing Ignatius invites us to do is to ask, what are our desires? Desires are a holy thing. God can be found in the experience of desire within my life. If we begin by asking God to allow me to desire what it is He desires for me, then I explore it. Ignatius invites us to dream. Ignatius is a very imaginative saint. He was the kind of guy that said, imagine yourself at the Nativity and you're the donkey. What do you see? I don't really think that way. But he does invite us in our discernment to say, well, what if I go down this path? What would that look like? What would that mean in my life? And to really try and think that through and think that out in a way that helps me to kind of recognize where that might go. To explore all the options that way. To begin with desiring God helps me to go to deeper desires. What are the biggest desires of my life? To begin with desiring God helps me to see when my desires are disordered, when they're not holy. But if I allow myself to imagine the future, the questions before me, then I'm able on some level to begin to understand where does my heart rest. One of the first questions I'd ask guys when I'd sit down with them in the sermon is I'd say, what is it that attracts you to the priesthood? And what I wanted to hear was them describe themselves to priests. What would that look like? What does that mean? When I sit down with couples and we talk about their excitement, I say, you know, you have discerned that you are going to be married to each other. That's a wonderful thing. What the church is inviting you to look at now is, what does that look like, really, concretely? What does that mean for you in the way that you choose to live that out? To really allow ourselves to kind of dream what this thing looks like and to walk down that process. And then, once I've done that, once I've looked at it with all the big questions, how does this fit in to what I think about myself, what I think about God, then to really ponder those desires. And this is where consolation and desolation becomes important. And then we'll end, because I'm late, Tom. I'm sorry. When we look at those desires and we think about the future, then we need to ask the question, where does my heart rest? Where does my heart rest? When I think about that particular path, do I feel a sense of holiness? Do I feel close to God? Do I feel like a movement towards faith, hope, charity? Do I want to share it with other people? Do I have a deep sense of peace? Most of all, perhaps, do I feel an invitation? Or do I feel myself moving away from faith, hope, and love? Does the contemplation of that leave me with a sense of distance or disquiet, boredom, fear, anxiety, or the desire to be secret, to hide? Those are the questions of discernment. If we are in a place of consolation and we think about the direction that those are going, when I am in a place of prayer, when I am in a place in the presence of my God, where do I feel an invitation? And where do I feel a sense of disquiet? That's the fundamental question in discernment. And as I test that, and as I pray with that over and over again, I'm called to trust the sense of consolation. Because, my brothers and sisters, that's how God speaks. He doesn't speak to us in anxiety, fear, and anger. He speaks to us in hope and trust. And I'm talking a deep peace, not a surface peace. Because sometimes we have to do the hard thing, right? And that's not necessarily a very peaceful thing. But deep down, the sense that this is the right thing. The thing that I'm called to do. Sometimes, the wrong decision can be the easy one. Avoidance. Or somehow, just kind of my easy way out. But that leaves me with a sense of deep agitation. Think about St. Elizabeth greeting St. Mary. How can this happen to me, that the mother of my Lord should come to me, because from the moment your voice greeted my ears, the infant in my womb leapt for joy. That sense of joy, of deep peace, is something we're called to trust. And that doesn't mean we can walk out of prayer and immediately have doubts and stuff like that erupt around us. But we're called to trust that deep intuition and to follow that. The great temptation, the great tempter that we find that sense of consolation is to try to tell us it's all wrong. And it's easy for us then to run away. But we're called to stay faithful to that until God shows us another path. The last thing I want to say, very quickly, last thing I want to say about discernment, it was a very freeing homily when I was in seminary. Because, you know, we're all sitting there going, "Are you calling me the priesthood?" I'm really wrestling with that. And he got up in chapel and said, "Gentlemen, you're called to know..." They always said that, by the way, "Gentlemen, you're called to know, love, and serve God. That's your vocation. Everything else will be okay. Regardless of what you do. If you know, love, and serve God, it'll be okay." I think that's important to remember. That in any decision we make, little or big, any decisions we make, that we follow the consolation of God, ultimately our call is to know and love and serve God with everything that we have. And if we are doing that, no matter what path we make, whether it's right or wrong, if we know, love, and serve God, that in fact is pleasing to Him. And it will be okay. Glory to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, for all without end. Amen.
Let's pray for you. God bless you all. Have a great evening.